Stå opp på Radio Rock med Olav, Anne og Henrik.
Hver morgen fra 6 til 10 leverer vi Stå opp Norges minst proffe morgenprogram, men også kanskje det morsomste. Vi vil at Radio Rock-lytterne skal få den best mulige starten på dagen med fjas og tull og ekte rock.
Ja, men det jo ikke sikkert at det passer akkurat deg å starte dagen slik, eller akkurat på det tidspunktet.
Så, hvis du gikk glipp av Stå opp på Radio Rock, kan du alltid høre Stå opp podcast akkurat når og hvor du vil.
Så går ikke du glipp av ett eneste middelmådig minutt.
Stå opp hver morgen på Radio Rock, eller når du vil, overalt der du hører podcast.
En podcast fra Tid og Lyst.
3, 2, 1. When lift off.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, end of bed. Okay, we checked all four systems, and there you go on modulation, all four, and keying with a go.
Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed.
Okay.
That's the kind of listeners we have. Okay, great. So, let's go, Nils-Johan.
Yeah, let's go. Dette altså, jeg vil kalle det, Eirik, høydepunktet.
Ja.
Det blir ikke bedre enn dette.
Det gjør ikke det,
for det, altså, med all respekt til andre eksperter og spennende folk vi har intervjuet og kommer til å intervjue i denne podcasten, så det nå altså, sånn kulhetsnivå på cirka 1000.
Ja.
For Gaute Einevold, nesten astronaut,
Her har vi full blown, skikkelig astronaut. Det blir ikke mer astronaut enn dette.
Nei, så bare vær forberedt. Resten av dette kommer til å foregå på engelsk,
ja.
Da vi enn så lenge dessverre ikke har så veldig mange. Det finnes to kanskje astronauter som skjønner hva vi sier akkurat nå.
Ja.
Og de har vi ikke fått snakke med. Men Mike Massimino, he is here. Thank you so much for being on our podcast, Mike.
Nils, thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So we just introduced you to our Norwegian listeners, but as we were saying, at the moment you're a professor of mechanical engineering. Is this correct?
That's correct. Yes, I'm a professor at Columbia University in New York City.
And you are a former NASA astronaut. You have had this long and varied career. I mean, if you Google him, you'll find that he has had two flights to fix the Hubble Space Telescopes, and we'll get into that very soon. But you will also, and you need to do this, go on Google, go on YouTube, and you will find lectures and podcasts and talk show appearances and even clips from the Big Bang Theory. And also, you have written this very good book that I read, Spaceman, and we'll link to it in the show notes. So, people, this is going to be interesting.
I hope so.
Yeah. Okay, Nils-Johan.
Yeah. First of all, Mike, just to get us into space. When you're there and you are about to fix a $1 billion piece of equipment, what I like to hear from you first is the attention to detail and preparation and drilling and planning, it's extreme, and there is a good reason for why it is that meticulous, isn't it?
Yeah, we try to plan out as much as we can. We have just a certain amount of time to get the job done, particularly with the Hubble Space Telescope missions. We only went up to visit the telescope every few years, and we don't go anymore. I mean, the only way we were able to service a telescope was with the space shuttle. So particularly on the last mission, we knew that this was going to be the last time that we could service Hubble. And so every minute counted, and there was a challenge out there to all the engineers and people we were working with who were working on the spacewalks. If you could, you know, if you could save a minute of spacewalking time, that was very valuable. So every minute counted. And so therefore, we had to try to plan out as best we could. And even then, you knew that things were not going to go the way you planned. And so you needed to be very agile, be able to pivot, be resourceful, resilient, because things are going to change. They never go. No spacewalk went according to plan. You plan as much as you can, you practice, but then when you do it, you know, things go wrong or new things come up you didn't expect, and you need to react to it. So the plan is to be, you need to be very flexible as well. Yeah. quickly.
There's a moment there on the last mission. I think that was STS-125. And as you said, it was the final chance to fix this unique telescope, which is actually still working. I mean, the Hubble is up there. And you obviously, you did a good job because it's still delivering pictures to astronomers all over the world. And I'm thinking, when reading your book, and there's a moment where you have to, you're replacing the power supply board inside the Hubble Space Telescope, which was this kind of different from, for instance, when you replaced the camera. I mean, it seemed to be more complicated than just pulling out, or not just, of course, it's complicated anyway, but it was a different level of complexity.
Oh yeah, by a long shot. It was very different. It was the most complicated spacewalk we ever attempted. Up till that point on all of our missions to Hubble, and pretty much on all the missions that we ever did where it involved spacewalking, you would remove a piece of equipment in total. And the equipment, whether it was an instrument or some, you know, a power supply or, you know, a battery or a gyroscope or whatever it was, whatever the equipment was, either on Hubble or on the space station, what we would do is we would unhook it with a series of connectors or bolts, and we had tools to do that, and it was fairly standard. As you said, it wasn't simple, but it was pretty standard. We tried to make it as simple as possible. For that repair we were doing for the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph, which was a very valuable instrument, it was able to do things like analyze the atmospheres of planets and other solar systems. So this is a pretty good science instrument, of course, but it had a power supply failure, as you mentioned, and that was inside of this instrument that's about the size of a refrigerator, and we did not have a replacement. We couldn't just move the entire box out and put a new one in. We didn't have a replacement for it, so the spacewalk was planned to take the instrument apart. It was never intended to ever be taken apart. It was built, put together, and launched into space. So really tightly put together so it could withstand launch and all the rigors of being in space. And now we were going to undo all that. And we designed 100 new tools to do that spacewalk, and a lot of practice, a lot of time. And even then, you know, not everything went smoothly, but we were able to, in the end, finish the job and replace that power supply, and the instrument is still working.
Mm. And when you're there, when you're doing these operations that you've drilled, you've planned them out, if something goes wrong, it's not like you can just pop in at, auto store to get a new bolt or whatever. How does that affect the way you go about the work?
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, what I did on that task, we had a lot of complicated things, but a very easy thing was to remove a handrail that was in the way for the repair, and it had four large bolts on it, and I stripped one of those bolts and realized that I wasn't going to be able to continue with the repair. And I remember looking down at the planet, and I think we were over like the Pacific Ocean at that time, and I was like, wow, the closest, as you say, the closest auto parts store, the closest hardware store is a long way away. What are we going to do? But we were able to improvise, and luckily with the help of our ground control team, we're able to figure out a solution. But yeah, you don't have everything that you want there. You know, you have to try to think as much as you can about what you would need. We did have lots of tools when I created that problem. And we started working on solutions to try to get that handrail off with an alternate method. I was getting tools from all over the place, so we had tools all over the place. Meaning, they need to be outside in the payload bay of the shuttle or in the toolbox if you're on the space station. You can't really go back inside to get something. You know, it's really just impractical to repress the airlock, get a tool, and go back outside. So you need everything available to you. And one of the things we think of is there are certain things you're going to be using constantly, things like tethers, things like your power tool, maybe a wrench or something like that, your trash bag, those things you want on you, on your tool belt. We actually have what we call the mini workstation, kind of like a tool belt that you could wear on your spacesuit. So those are the things you're going to be using all the time. So think about any repair job you might be working in your house or in your garage or in your car, whatever it might be. You have to do you're going to do something. You want certain things right here with you, right? Then there are other things we would have on a tool stanchion or in the airlock. On the tool stanchion moves around with you, so those tools aren't right there, but they move with you so you can get them a little more, more quickly than if you left some in the airlock. So we would leave some in the airlock to go back and get. And then there were others that were in toolboxes around the space shuttle. So you know what's out there, and there's so many things out there. I didn't really know everything that was out there, but we have people on our ground team that knows where all the extra parts are and other tools we could use. And so those things are out there for you. So it's a good point is that if something's left inside the spaceship, or worse, if it's something's on the ground, you can't get it. You're far away from it. So, but that's part of the planning is what do I need on me all the time and what do I need nearby?
But also, as Nils Johan said, there's sort of the pressure here because this is not, if you fail at this task, I think you write in your book that you were worried about being the guy who killed space-based astronomy. So, it's not a small thing. And being able to handle this stress, because there's a lot of stress involved with this. You're already out in space, and I'm guessing that spacewalking also takes a bit out of you. And So how do you do that? You train for a long time at NASA, but do you also need a special kind of mindset to even be able to do it?
I think Nils, what it is you need to have I think it's the training more than anything else. I don't think that, at least I don't think I, some people are calmer than others, or but I think really what it is in the training and being prepared. And as you say, when I stripped the screw, I realized I'm not going to get that handrail. The screw's not coming out. Handrail's not coming off. Access panel's not coming out. We're not changing out the power supply today. We'll never bring the instrument back to life. We'll never find out if there's life on other planets. And everyone in the world will always blame me.
Yeah.
I was the guy that did this, I'd be blamed forever, and I was like, oh boy, this is terrible. So, but I think, we train a lot and we practice things and we share stories and it really is a big team effort. The thought of going out and doing these things can be a little bit, it can be a lot, it can be very intimidating. And so much so that you would say to yourself, I don't think I can do it. How can I do this? But once you practice it and you plan and you're actually doing it, you're ready to go. So I think I don't think there's necessarily, something that you're born with. I think it's good not to be a person that panics. But I think that in most cases, for me anyway, and I think for a lot of other people, you're trained that way. So I think that, I see like now that I'm no longer an astronaut, and I'm out here in the real world. People get excited about all kinds of things that I'm like, what are you worried about? It's not the end of the world. No one's going to die here. And we're not ruining science for the rest of the world forever, I'm like, just let's calm down here, what's the problem? So I think that I don't know if I was like that before I became an astronaut. I think that the experience of being an astronaut with all the training we did and I think it's for military people is the same. A lot of our training was, I think, similar to what people get in the military to execute a mission. And because you're trained, I think that, you're able to handle these situations. I think for me, it wasn't necessarily natural. I think it was more of something that was learned of how to not to panic, to think clearly, to remember that you're going to make mistakes and your team is there to help you, and how to just remain calm when something goes bad. And so for me, I think it was learned as opposed to something I was born with.
Yeah, and you write, and you've also talked a lot about this, about how you got into being an astronaut, and that's a question we get quite often from our listeners: is how do you get into the space business? How do you become an astronaut? And I think your story was actually very interesting in that respect, because you often think, and I think also as Norwegians, we often think of astronauts as being sort of pilots and, as you say, having a military background. But you were a mission specialist, is that correct?
Correct.
And that's a different kind, and that's a different kind of training. And I think that that was something that NASA introduced with the Space Shuttle program. Is that right?
That's right, Nils. Yes. Yeah, the space. So I think as far as what it takes, it changes, and it you never know how it's going to change. I think you can, it's hard to predict change, right? When I was a little boy, I was 6 years old when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And back then, just about all of the astronauts back then were military test pilots. There was a couple scientists. The last person to walk on the moon was Harrison Schmitt, a friend of mine who's still around, good guy, you know, and just a very nice man. He was a geologist. He was the only one out of all the astronauts up to that point, you know, starting with Alan Shepard on the first American flight, all the way through all the Apollo missions. He was the first one who wasn't a military test pilot. He was a geologist. And so he was a bit different. And at that ended the shuttle, the Apollo program. When they moved on to the shuttle program, they opened it up to a lot of civilians, the first people of color, the first women were selected in the space shuttle program. And actually the space shuttle program started when I was in college. So I went from, you know, 6 years old seeing Neil Armstrong to being a college student, a university student, and seeing the space shuttle come along. And I wasn't going to become a military test pilot. So I kind of gave up on the idea of ever becoming an astronaut. I was like, nah, I didn't think becoming a military pilot was something that I was able to do or wanted to do necessarily. I thought it would be really cool, but I was more interested in becoming an engineer. And then when the shuttle program came around, just, you know, by accident, I realized that, wow, now the astronauts are not just military test pilots. And as you said, I was considered a mission specialist. So what they did is with the shuttle program, they really, there were two categories of astronauts. One was a pilot astronaut and the other one was mission specialist. And the reason they did that is that the selection and training for those two positions were somewhat similar, but also different enough that they wanted to make the distinction. So the pilot category, they needed a pilot to fly the space shuttle. The space shuttle was flown by a person. There was no automatic landing. It was a pilot landing that the shuttle. It required an enormous amount of training, and it also required a background experience of being a military test pilot at some point. We did have some pilots who were former military test pilots and became civilian pilots. Now they were still eligible, but you needed that sort of background, thousands of hours in high performance jets, in order to be a person qualified to train to land the space shuttle. But they also needed a different kind of astronaut who could do experiments and spacewalks and work the robot arm and understand the systems and so on. And so for that, we had the mission specialist category. So we had we all were trained together. The pilots were trained more in the landings. The mission specialists were trained more in the spacewalks and robotics and experiments. But we all had a lot of overlap training. We're all part of the same astronaut classes. And of course, we all flew together in space. You had different positions. Now it's back to just being an astronaut, because there's no vehicle that really requires that much flying that you would need a military test pilot. You'd need astronauts who have that. We have a variety of people who are military test pilots or also scientists and engineers. But the jobs now are cross-trainable. So now even the military test pilots that are selected as astronauts, they're also doing spacewalks and working the robot arm and doing those things. And the astronauts who were selected as mission specialists, there's no real flying on, you know, you're not landing on a runway right now. So they're able to do a lot of the flying tasks as well. So it's changed a lot, and it will continue to change, I think, particularly now with the privatization that's going on, where there's going to be other people going into space who aren't even astronauts for their governments. They're working for private companies.
By the way, you mentioned the manipulator arm or the Canada arm, and this is how you got into the space program, wasn't it? I mean, when you started out studying went to university and went to college, you were accepted at MIT, which is a pretty elite college, I think we all know. As you said, there were about all the best people from all over the world were there, and. Yeah. And you decided to focus on the sort of human robot space robotic systems. Yeah. And was that also part of your plan to eventually end up in space, or were you simply driven by your fascination for robotics?
It was it was a little bit of both, but mainly I think in all these situations of what to decide to do to try to be involved in the space program or become an astronaut, or I think do anything in life, I think one needs to follow what you're interested in and what you're passionate about. And to become an astronaut, and I think to become most things in life, there are different ways to do it. There isn't just one way. There are many different ways to do it. And so for me, there were some decisions that needed to be made. I wanted to be part of the space program. I really admire the people that went into the military. I think I would have enjoyed being a military person, but I didn't think that's what I wanted to do more than becoming an engineer or a research engineer. So I decided to stick with engineering. And when I got the interest after college, I was working for IBM in New York as an engineer, and I decided I wanted to try to do something with the space program and try to become an astronaut. And I was accepted at MIT. Then the question was, well, what do I want to do there? What kind of research do I want to do? What kind of program do I want to set up? Because graduate school, at least here in the United States, is much different than it is as an undergrad. Undergrad, you're taking lots of undergraduate, your college education, your first 4 years for your bachelor's degree. You're taking lots of basic classes, and everyone more or less takes the same stuff. You have a major in mechanical engineering or civil engineering, industrial engineering, or whatever engineering you want, electrical engineering, whatever engineering you want to go into if you're an engineer or whatever your major might be. But in grad school, it's a little more specific. And I had taken classes when I was in college that dealt a little bit with robotics, but also human factors. And what I thought was kind of interesting, there was this question of, do robots or machines robots or people are better for space exploration? You know, what's better? And what I thought was that it's not necessarily what's better. It's how do you work together? How do people and machines work together to accomplish work in space? And so that was something I think through some of the classes I took when I was in college at Columbia University is where I teach now, but that's where I went for my first 4 years of college. And then I took a break and then went to MIT, as you mentioned, for graduate school. But some of those classes I took at Columbia and in with my interest in what I wanted to pursue in space, I thought that's where I wanted to go. You know, humans controlling robotic systems, how does that allow you to explore space, both for things like the space station and the space shuttle, but also for planetary exploration? So that's what I got into. At MIT, it was a perfect place to get a chance to study those things. Mm.
And with your background and fascination for robotics and your experience, your firsthand experience with it in space, how do you see the combination between robotics in space and manned exploration now and in the future?
I think it's really a partnership. I don't think it's one or the other. I think that really it's both. And there are things that people can do that robots are not able to do, and there are things that robots can do that people aren't as good at. So one thing is, you know, we're able to put a robotic system on Mars right now. The rovers have been doing really well up there. But they're limited in what they can do. People can cover a lot more ground and make decisions and won't get stuck as easily as a robot will, but you don't have to worry about you don't have to worry as much about keeping a robot alive. You have to keep it working
and communicate with it. But there are advantages and disadvantages to each. And I think there is a role for both. And I think there always will be a role for both humans and machines in exploring space and working together. In most cases, is what I think we're gonna continue to see.
But do you in the more I would say what are you gonna call it philosophical way of looking at it, do you value the part of people in space just for the sake of people in space?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think there's that whole other element of it. I mean, the practical part of it is that what we did, for example, on the Hubble missions, we tried looking at a machine to do it, robots doing it, and it really, you're not able to. For a lot of the tasks that we do, we need people still to do them. Now, maybe someday robots will be able to do everything a human can do, but right now we're not there. But even so, I mean, that's the practical engineering answer, right? But then there's also, I think, the human answer or the emotional answer or the answer, you know, from your heart and soul is that if people are truly going to experience things and appreciate them, people need to participate. You know, when we landed on the moon, what made that so astonishing was that it was a person walking on the moon, that we sent a person there. You know, that's what we remember 50 years later that we celebrated 2 years ago in 1969 was the 50th anniversary of landing a person on the moon. The Russians actually landed a robotic craft. They never landed a person there, but they landed a vehicle there, a spacecraft on the moon before the United States landed a person. And that was a great accomplishment, but it's not what we remember. What we remember was the sending a person there, and particularly sending a person there. Apollo 8 was when we sent a person there on Apollo 8, they orbited the moon. But then on Apollo 11, of course, is when we actually walked on the moon. And both of those missions were historic. Of course, Apollo 11 maybe more so because they actually got out of the spaceship, they landed and walked around.
Yeah.
But that's what we remember. You know, we remember people being involved. And so I think that's just because we're human. And I don't think we can deny the fact that we're human. we want to participate. We want to engage things on a very personal level. Not everyone can do those things, but certainly we can send people to be our representatives to do these things and we can share with them.
I think that's very true, and as you said, you actually remember watching Neil Armstrong stepping onto the moon, right? When you were 6 years old. Yeah,
I was 6 years old.
Oh,
I was 6 years old.
Yeah, you were lucky. I was 5 at the moment, and my parents didn't have a TV, so I didn't get to see it. Yeah, I agree.
I wasn't born.
And Niels Johan wasn't born. But anyway, yeah. I remember watching the later missions, and I remember how it inspired me. Also, I was educated as an astrophysicist, and there were so many people also here in Norway and all over the world who were inspired by that mission.
Yeah.
I remember watching the launch program on, I think it was CBS, with Walter Cronkite just before the launch of the Saturn V to the moon, Apollo 11. And he was talking to the writer Arthur C. Clarke. And he said, "What do you think we will get out of it?" And he said, "Hasn't it been very expensive?" And Arthur C. Clarke replied that this is the best investment that the USA has ever made. He said, "You will get payoff in so many ways, in so many years." And I think he was completely right, because not just because of the technological spin-off, but also because that inspiration thing, right?
Yeah, no, and I think. I think that there's a lot there. One thing you mentioned was that it was important in Norway as well. It inspired people in Norway. It inspired people
Definitely.
All over the world. I think it was one of the few things ever, maybe perhaps the only thing that has ever happened that truly inspired the whole world. And what Alan Bean, who was the fourth person to walk on the moon, on he was on Apollo 12, the mission, of course, right after Apollo 11. And he no longer is with us, but he was a good friend of mine and my mentor, and I miss him very much. But I'm lucky that I did get to spend time with him, and he would tell me stories. And he told me how when they went traveling the world after their mission, that it was never "you did it, the Americans did it." It was always "we did it." No matter where he was, he could be in Europe or he could be in Japan or he could be anywhere in the world, and it was "we did it." People felt like it was a human accomplishment, not just an American accomplishment, that the world had done this and that everyone took part. And they did. It was because it was that sort of thing. It wasn't just for a government doing it. It was people doing it. And these were our first people that left the planet and went somewhere else for real, going to the moon. So that's that part of it. And I think you're right. I think it's really hard to quantify the benefits of the space program. It's been going on for a long time of trying to, what is your return on the investment and is it worth it? And it's hard to put a number on it. But certainly, I think overall it is, I think, a tremendous investment because it's the future. It's an investment in the future. A lot of the benefits we get from space and from science and research don't happen the next day. It takes a while. So that's one thing, but it's an investment in the future. It's also a way to inspire people, as you said. I mean, it inspired me as a young boy, and it has inspired so many people. So for education and inspiration, I mean, you can't really put a price tag on that either. International cooperation. We are cooperating with Norway and all the countries of the European Space Agency, along with the Russians and the Japanese and the Canadians and other countries as well. Israel's going to be sending another astronaut to space. So there's the UAE has sent an astronaut to space recently, so two astronauts to space. So it's international cooperation. It's something we can agree on, different governments can agree on. And I do think the economic benefit is there as well. And I think we're going to start seeing that benefit big time as we now have the commercialization of space and the privatization of space. So we're not seeing, I think that's 50 years later. But all of these benefits that we're seeing now and that we'll continue to see into the future, I think were a result of that huge investment that was made back in the 1960s to get people on the moon.
Det 20 år siden NOKAS-ranet, Norges historiens største ran.
Jeg så ikke for meg ran, da. Jeg tenkte meg slå spritbubler. Jeg er ikke alt.
Erling Havnå får jobben med å slå seg inn med slegge.
Hvis vi klarer å inn ut der, bare hente penger, og satt en rekord som aldri kan slå oss, penger seg selv er ikke jeg så veldig interessert.
Ranerne stikker av med 57 millioner kroner, men en politimann blir skutt og drept.
Nei, da tenkte jeg, det var over. Det kommer ikke noe.
Hør slegge mannen i podcasten Avhørt, gratis der du lytter til podcast.
Let's talk a little bit more about people, but let's bring it down to a smaller number of people, the astronaut community and how the astronauts for all the different flights connect and become, I guess, friends.
And family. You mentioned it just now with Al Bean. As you said, he was a friend, and you also talked about Harrison Schmitt, and that's kind of interesting because I had sort of imagined that there are many astronauts and not that many flights, so I would imagine that it would be a sort of a cutthroat environment where you were sort of always competing, and then you talk about this, and I also read about this, and I get, as Nils Johan says, I get sort of the impression that it's more like a family.
Yeah, it is, and that's an important thing to realize is that teamwork is really important, and in the U.S. at least the U.S. model is you have a lot more astronauts, and everyone gets a couple flights, hopefully, as opposed to other countries like Russia, for example, has fewer cosmonauts, but they refly a lot of their people. A lot, over and over again, they get more flights, more time. And we the U.S. model is to spread it around a little bit more. But as far as like the cutthroat part of it, I think that doesn't work in the space business. And I don't think it works in most businesses. I think that the world today is pretty complex. Our missions are certainly complex, but I think everything that people are doing in business and in almost any job that you have now, there's a lot of complexity to it. You know, things aren't simple anymore. And it requires more people to be involved, to check on each other and to work as a team and rely on each other. And you can't do that if you're trying to hold the other person down. You really need to help each other. And for me, the teamwork aspect of it, you mentioned it, a family. Yeah, I mean, Alan Bean and Harrison Schmitt were well before my time. You know, they were astronauts in the 60s and early 1970s. And I was an astronaut in the 90s and 2000s. And but you get to know these people. You get to know the people that came before you, and you get to know the people that came after you. So it is sort of like this very nice family to be a part of. But to give you an example of the teamwork aspect of it, when I first was selected by NASA as an astronaut, we were called on the phone, and they say, you know, you've been selected, and you say, yeah, that's great. You know, I'm happy to thank you very much, and you're very excited about it. And then you get a they actually ask you if you're still interested in the job. And I was like, yes, I'm still interested in the job. It's kind of funny. But then I got a letter in the mail. You know, like they send you a packet of information, right? A packet, you know, stuff to fill out and information, and, you know, in an envelope, a thick envelope. And in the letter, the very first letter, it said, like, congratulations, and, you know, report for work on this day. If you need help, call this person. And then it was something, there was another paragraph about, please practice your swimming. And I'm like, what is this about? And it said that we were going to have to pass a swim test in order to go to water survival training with the U.S. Navy. And a lot of, if you don't practice and you're not a good swimmer, you're going to show up. You're going to do that. One of the first things you're going to do is take this swim test. And if you don't pass, it's going to put you behind, and it's a problem. And I'm like, oh, man, because I was not a very strong swimmer. I never liked the water very much. I was always cold. I was a skinny kid. My mother made me go to swim lessons, and I didn't like it. And so I never really learned to swim very well. And I'm like, holy cow, now I got to do this in front of all these other astronauts. This is going to be terrible. So I practiced as much as I could. And when we showed up for work that first week, it was a lot of administrative stuff to do. But at the end of our first week, the second week is when we were going to start our training. And if the first event was going to be this swim test on this Monday. And so on the Friday before, right before the swim test, our class leader, who was an experienced astronaut, came in to speak to us. And he said, okay, before you go home for the weekend, Monday is the swim test. And I'm like, oh, you know, now party's over. And he said, who are the strong swimmers in this group? And a couple people raised their hand. And then he asked, who are the weak swimmers in this group? And don't lie to me. And I raised my hand. And then he said, okay, everyone else can go home. But the strong swimmers and the weak swimmers stay after class. You're going to arrange a time to meet over the weekend at a swimming pool. And the strong swimmers are going to help the weak swimmers with their swimming. Because when we go to the pool on Monday, no one leaves the pool until everyone passes that test. And I remember hearing that and realizing this was a whole new way of operating, that that your success is not measured on your individual success, is measured on the success of the team. You leave no one behind. You help when you can. You do your best not to hold back everybody else. I mean, I don't want to be the guy failing and making everyone else fail. So we got together over the weekend. We practiced. I got help from some of the better swimmers, and we got there on Monday, and everyone passed. And so I think that, to me, sums up the teamwork and attitude we had, that your job was to help the other person when you could and to get help when you needed it. And that's what we're looking for in astronauts at NASA. And I would say, from my experience at the European Space Agency as well, and all the other agencies we work with, we're looking for that type of person. And, you know, it's one thing to be really smart and accomplished or to act like you know everything, but it's another thing to be the kind, you said family. You know, when you're looking for new astronauts, you know, you're looking for someone who you would want as a family member. And it's funny because I hear, you know, when I was trying to become an astronaut, I would hear stories from these people that had figured it all out. You know, they knew exactly what they needed to do to become an astronaut. And, you know, they knew the whole city, knew everything, and they were going to become astronauts. And I was like, okay, I guess you know what you're doing. I don't have any idea. And, you know, I was lucky enough to get picked. And I think a lot of it was, you know, a lot of those people who thought they knew what they were doing didn't. And I think that is because it's not, you know, you're looking for something to be a good astronaut. As you mentioned earlier, you really need to be like a good family member. And you want to trust, you want to be able to be, you need to be trusted. You need to be able to trust other people. Because your lives are at stake, your mission success is at stake, and you have to rely on people. And so that's why I think, you know, I do a fair amount of speaking to various companies, and I share some of these stories and others with them to, you know, to share what we were like at NASA in our astronaut office, because teamwork was so important, and you needed to help each other and stick together. And as a result, I think the strongest relationships I have in my life outside of my immediate family or my colleagues that I flew in space with, because it's kind of like a hybrid of friendship and working colleague and family member. The other way, we're all brothers and sisters doing this together.
Yeah. I was watching, it was also sort of integrated into the system. I was reminded, just the other day, I was watching Apollo 13, one of my favorite movies, of course.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Oh, yeah, it's a great movie. And the soundtrack is just wonderful.
Oh, yeah. But,
I think James Horner, I think he's called the composer. I flew
a copy of that movie in space, by the way.
You did, yeah, of course. I was also reminded that how NASA uses astronauts when they both to communicate with astronauts up in space. So while the astronauts were having their problems, you had I think it's Capcom, people on the ground who communicate with the astronauts. And also how astronauts were used to take care of the family. There's a scene there where Jim Lovell's mother is watching her son on TV, and Neil and Buzz are there, and she's asking them, "Oh, so you're into space too?"
but, you boys in the space program too,
right? Yeah. And it's a wonderful scene, but it's also a reminder how NASA has sort of used astronauts as resources in many ways. And I was reminded this also when, because you also have had this role, haven't you? And I'm thinking specifically, you flew on Columbia, the space shuttle, in 2002 on your first mission, and then Columbia's next mission ended in tragedy, right? STS-107. One of the things I didn't know that you write about is that you were one of the last people to talk to the crew aboard Columbia STS-107. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. I was good friends with just everyone on that crew. Three of my classmates, three of my astronaut classmates, Willie McCool, Laurel Clark, and Dave Brown were on that mission. My very good friend, Elon Ramon, who was the Israeli astronaut. I had spent the Christmas holidays with him and his family at another astronaut's house right before. I mean, that flight happened in January, and a month earlier, we were together celebrating the holiday season together with our families. I knew him. And Rick Husband was a very good friend of mine. He was the commander. So as a Capcom, I had worked as a Capcom in mission control, but I wasn't working as a Capcom for that mission. But I was working as Capcom for the space station. While their mission was up. So we had, they were not going to space station. So we had a control room talking to them about the space shuttle. And we had a control room talking to the astronauts who were in space on the space station. And that accident occurred on a Saturday morning in the United States. The time was like 8 a.m. Saturday morning in Texas. And where I lived, where we were in mission control. And that Friday, I was finishing up my shift on a Friday afternoon. And the flight surgeon, a good friend of mine, and who was very good friends with the crew, he was their flight surgeon, and the doctor for the crew, his name is Smith Johnston, still a very good friend of mine. He came by the control room where I was, and he said, "Hey, I'm about to do a medical check, you know, a call with the crew. And I want to do this thing to, you know, keep, you know, to kind of, to entertain them, to make them laugh. I would like you to come with me as a mystery guest." and we'll talk to them and, you know, get them ready for landing. They're going to go to sleep soon, and they're going to wake up and try to land. And I want, you know, would you, want to come with them? I'm like, yeah, let me just finish up this shift. And I'll, you know, I was in still in the control center. So I finished up what I was doing for the space station, and I went with Smith. I met him, and we went into the secure area, and we were able to talk to the crew. And it was, you know, I was introduced as they had to guess who I was, and it didn't take very long because he described me as a New Yorker who was very tall. So Laurel Clark knew who I was, and I got to speak to all of them and ask them how they were doing, and they were sharing some stories, and we were looking forward to seeing them. And, you know, Rick Cusman kept thanking me for his time and for my time to come by and say hi, and it was great. It was great to get to talk to them. And, you know, I said, I'll see you guys in a couple of days when you get back. And a call went for about 15 or 20 minutes. And that was it. And then the next morning, you know, we got the news that they weren't coming back. So that was, pretty amazing experience, you know, and it hit me probably about midway through that Saturday that, holy cow, I just spoke to those guys, you know, and now we're not getting them back. I think about them all the time. It took about a year for me to feel better about that whole thing. I don't feel good about it, but it took about a year for me to be able to start thinking about how lucky I was to have known them than how sad I was that they were gone. And they were great. I mean, I miss them. I think about them all the time. I hear from their families. I try to every once in a while, and see how their families are doing. It's good to remain friends with them, of course. And but I miss them.
How does an experience like that, and also you have to kind of make how grim it may sound, preparations, because when you get into the space shuttle and you're sitting on a bomb and you're going off to space, you've had to make some and do some thinking about your own life and the risk that's involved. And then you experience it, that the risk, the thing that everyone is aware might happen, and then it happens.
Yeah. You know, I think that I think that what we do in our lives, we only have, you know, one shot at this, as far as we know. And you want to make sure that what you're doing is something you think is important, is the way I look at it. And I think that that might mean then that you, if there's something that you're passionate about that you think is important, that involves a risk. And most things involve a risk. It might not necessarily, you might not think of it as a risk of your life, but I think you have to feel, I think it's important to feel that what you're doing is so important that you're willing to risk your life. I would rather do that than do something, doing something that I didn't care that much about. So I think being passionate enough about what you're doing that you think it's that important, I think that's a good thing. And when I first was thinking about becoming an astronaut and I was getting ready before I'd gone to MIT, we lost Space Shuttle Challenger. And when I saw that it didn't say, oh, no, this is dangerous. I knew it was dangerous. I saw that happen to Challenger. And I thought, well, I wanted to be there to try to help. I wanted to be there to maybe figure out what had happened. And it actually made me want to become an astronaut more, because you only have one life to give. You want to lead. You want to do something that you truly think is important with that life.
And also there's a special twist here as well, because you flew on Columbia STS-109, right?
Yeah.
And the accident happened with STS-107, so
right.
So were the missions switched around? Was that
Yeah, that's pretty observant. That's what happened. So we were both missions were scheduled for Space Shuttle Columbia. And when you get assigned, usually you order the numbers of the missions, and you picked it up on the numbers of the missions, which is good. The mission, they were assigned first, they were 107. And then we were going to fly after them, you know, about 6 months or so after them, we were scheduled to fly, and we were STS-109. Columbia, the spaceship, went out to Palmdale, California, to where, which is where it was built by Rockwell International, the company, to for an overhaul. And every few years, each space shuttle, you know, we had at that time we had four of them working, and they would go out there and go for an overhaul, and the other three would be going to space, and then they would get flown back to the Kennedy Space Center on top of a 747 to go again. And when Columbia came back to the, and we were assigned, ready to go, 107 was going to go, we were going to go after them. When Columbia got back from that overhaul from California and it landed and they started checking it out, there was something obscure that was not right. It was something with the paint or something that needed to be changed. And they needed to change it before it could fly. And it was going to keep it on the ground longer than expected to fix this problem that it came back with. And it was this crazy thing that they couldn't understand why this happened like this, but they needed to fix it. And what that was going to do is it was going to delay both flights. The STS-107 crew, that was a space lab flight. As I said earlier, they weren't going to the space station. It was experiments that were important, of course, but they could wait. Whereas going to Hubble, people get nervous. You know, the program got nervous because Hubble staying up there too long without being serviced, things could happen, and they didn't want to wait too much longer to go to Hubble. So they switched our flights, the order, and we went before they did. We got their tank, their system, and they got ours, and we came back and they didn't. And that hit me like 2 days after the accident. I think like the afternoon after, I was like, holy cow. Because we were switched in the order, right. and we got their spot and they got ours, and they didn't come back. So yeah, you know, you never know. The risk involved with it is, you know, that we always knew it was risky. It wasn't like it added anything. It didn't add any new information.
No.
That, oh, hey, wow, we could get hurt doing this. It really didn't. I remember Kevin Kriegel, very good friend of mine, who is a pilot, an experienced shuttle pilot and commander, and good friend of mine. He was the first person I saw the day of the accident. We were walking in the building. We were all called into work to get a briefing on what happened and what we could do. And we were all just devastated. But the first guy I looked down the hallway and Kevin was there, and I called his name and he stops and he looks at me and he's just shaking his head. And he goes, you know, Mike, we're all just playing Russian roulette, and you got to be grateful that you're not the one who got the bullet. And I think that that's kind of the way it is that, you know, you're taking that risk, and every once in a while you're going to have a bad outcome.
Yeah.
And that's what happened that day.
But I think you think that Columbia's crew might actually have been saved if NASA had been on its game. And I mean, I remember Apollo 13, I mean, which was a triumph. It almost ended in tragedy, but they managed to save it. And there are some scenes there about how hard they worked to get these astronauts back on the ground alive. And you get the sense that that crew wasn't, NASA wasn't on that game when Columbia was in trouble. Is that your, what do you think?
Well, no, I wouldn't categorize it like that. I think that you know, no one was trying to kill those guys, and
no.
You know, and accidents happen, and you look back in hindsight and you go, "Boy, were we stupid." None of us, even the cause of the accident. I mean, none of us even. I didn't believe that the cause of the when they started to talk about foam, because what happened was this foam came off the external tank and hit the wing. And that foam is so light, it doesn't even have any weight to it. It's very, very light. And none of us thought that, hey, that's what did it. You know, we thought it was something else. And then the investigation showed that that is what did it. And everyone, I think, feels stupid after something like this happens. But so I don't necessarily, I mean, I do not blame NASA for any of it. I think that looking back on it, was there things we could have done? Yeah, but in space, and we talked a little bit about, I think, the training and preparation for anything you're going to do in space, which includes the launch and all your spacewalks and everything else you're going to do. You think about, you know, everything that can go, you know, things that can go wrong, right? Because they have gone wrong. Oh, this happened, that happened. We got to be ready for this, that. Those things you're ready for. Then you imagine what else can happen. Okay, this could happen. That can happen. And you take care of those things. And then there's things that you don't even have the imagination to think about that could happen. Is this really a problem? And those are the things that usually get you. And sometimes you have a problem that you never imagined, like I did with my spacewalk, and I stripped a screw and we didn't have a plan for that, but we were able to figure it out because we had worked so many other problems. But other ones you don't. And the thing that happened to Columbia, we didn't know that they took a debris strike that was going to cause a problem. We didn't know they had a hole in a wing. You know, it was a bad timing of things. They did not have a robot arm to even inspect if there was any damage. They did not have a way to see if there was damage. They didn't have a way to repair it. I mean, no one thought there was any damage. You know, it was just, yeah, maybe you can look back at it and you can point fingers and you can say, hey, they should have done this and that. But I don't think it was really any real negligence. I think looking back at the Challenger accident, there was some voices who mentioned some of the issues that they thought could happen, and they were ignored. Launching in cold weather, for example, which is what happened. That was the Challenger accident. I think that was a little bit different. With what happened with Columbia, I mean, no one thought that this could have taken down a space shuttle. And, you know, should we have thought about it? Well, maybe, you know, but, you know, you can't, you try to think of everything, but no matter how hard you try, you still miss some things.
And then the second flight you were on, STS-125, one thing I wondered about myself, and I discovered when I read your book, you couldn't use the space station as a place to get more tools if you ran out of tools, or even to seek shelter if something went wrong. Right. Why couldn't you use the space station? I mean, you were in the shuttle, you were in space. Couldn't you just fly there?
No, you can't do that. In these movies, sometimes they go from space station to this place, that place. You know what? No, you can't. What it is, it's just orbital mechanics. And this is for your audience who likes math. If you look at orbital mechanics, you can change your altitude once you're in orbit. So in orbit, you're going 17,500 miles an hour. Okay. That's really fast. You can go faster. You can burn your engine and go faster, get more energy, and you'll go to a higher orbit. Or you can burn your engine into the velocity vector and slow down. Right. That's how it's kind of like putting the brakes on. You fire your engine into the direction that you're traveling, and that'll slow you down. And then your altitude will decrease and you'll come home. And that's how you can change your altitude. That's how we come back. We adjust our altitude so much. We slow down so much that gravity of the Earth pulls you in, actually speeds you up once that starts happening. But you get pulled into the Earth. So you can change your altitude. But in order to go to the space station, you would need to be in the same inclination orbit. The space station, I think, is at about 51 degrees inclination. The shuttle, the telescope was at 26 degrees. So different, and that is the inclination of the orbit with respect to the equator. That's the angle of the orbit. So two different inclinations. You're going that fast. It is impossible just about to make a left or a right turn. There's so much momentum built up. You can slow down or you can speed up, but there's no way you can overcome that momentum and go left or right, more or less, to change your inclination. You just can't do it. So that's why going to the space station was not an option.
Space.
Different inclinations.
Space is hard.
Oh my god, space is hard. And that's one of the things many people react to when they watch Gravity, when people say they're jumping all over the place, and I say it's not that easy.
You can't do it.
But
it was a good movie, I thought.
And the effects are magnificent. And then you have the and of course you land on the ground and you're still an astronaut. And then a bit later, you're offered a flight to the International Space Station, but you...
Why, Mike? Why?
Why? Why did you pass?
What happened?
What happened? Everybody dreams to go to the space station.
Looking back on it, I was like, well, I wonder if that was the right decision or not. But I think for me, the flights that I had on the Hubble, and I'd been an astronaut for a while. My family, at the time, my children were in high school, you know, they were teenagers. Back then, the training flow to go to the space station required lots of travel, to be away from home for a very long time, and even the flight was 6 months. But that's not really the issue. It was flying on Soyuz, so a lot of training in Russia. Yeah. Mm. So I think it was like a combination of that. Being involved with those Hubble flights to me was what I was meant to do. I wouldn't have known that when I first became an astronaut, but that's what I was meant to do. I felt like after those missions, I felt satisfied with what I had done in my astronaut career. I was at a point in my life where I wanted to be around my family a little. I didn't want to miss those critical years. I would have missed a lot in those years. And I felt there was still ways I could contribute, and you know, someone else could go in my place. And I didn't really feel like it would be that much of a loss to the program. There were other people that hadn't gone as often as I had, and so that's why I made that decision. You know, I don't know. I mean, looking back on it, if there were different circumstances, looking back on it now, you know, it sounds crazy to have done that. I still think about it. You know, what the heck was I thinking?
Yeah, I've been there, done that.
But, you know, yeah. there comes a time. You know, there's a, you know, a Marine pilot friend of mine, CJ Sterkow, says all good things must come to an end. And you know, I think for me, it was a decision that I made, which was kind of interesting. In some ways, it's easier if they tell you now you're not flying anymore. You know, that's what happened to a lot of people. Would said, all right, that's enough. Time to do something else. But for me, it was my decision, and I think that actually makes it tougher because offered that opportunity and didn't go. And that was based on the timing of it, you know, and timing has to do it a lot with it. I had flown a few times. I had been an astronaut for quite a while. I had done the missions that I felt like were for me, and I think the overarching thing really was my family situation. That I felt like it was better for me to stay on the earth than to go through that.
If a certain manufacturer of electrical cars now would approach you and say, "Hey, Mike, want to take a spin on my rocket?" Would you do
it? Yes, absolutely. Yes, I'll go.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yep. My kids are older now. It's okay. I can go.
So there you go, Elon, if you're listening in. As you said, you passed on the flight, and that was sort of a signal to NASA management that you were moving out of NASA, I guess. But
it was more. I think it was actually more of a signal to me, quite honestly. I remained an active astronaut after that. For at least over a year. And I think what it was more me telling myself, you know, you can tell a lot, you can think about things and want things in your brain, but when you actually, your actions, I think, tell you what you want to do. And when I turned down that flight, I said, what am I telling myself? You know, I would never have done this 10, 15 years ago, even 5 years ago. But I'm doing it now. And, you know, at that point, I'd been an astronaut for 15 years. And I think for whatever reason, that was probably enough.
Yeah. But since then, you've done a lot of work with, as we started with, you've done a lot of work with sort of talking about space travel and inspiring people. And we have to mention here that you were actually the first person to tweet from space, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you started using Twitter, and that was on STS-125 in 2009. And I have the tweet in front of me from Orbit. Orbit launch was awesome. I'm feeling great, working hard, and enjoying the magnificent views. The adventure of a lifetime has begun. and you're still on Twitter, and you're still an active user of social media, and also a sort of you're on YouTube. You're out there trying to inspire people, right?
Yeah, I think one thing I learned as an astronaut, right from the very beginning, we got some media training and to tell the stories of what it was like to be an astronaut. And I realized right from the beginning, I was probably better suited to do that than most of my colleagues. I enjoyed it very much. I was good at it. I liked connecting with people. I really enjoyed sharing what we were doing in the space program with people. I think it's extraordinary. I mean, like we're doing right now, you know, I've always enjoyed doing that. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason for me leaving too, is that NASA allowed us to do that, but there was also, you know, our job wasn't to be just to do that. Our job was to do other things, to fly in space. And you couldn't, there was a lot of opportunities I couldn't pursue as an astronaut. And I wanted to pursue, like writing a book and doing more in television and news and other things. And so that was part of my decision too, about what I wanted to do next. And so I've enjoyed that. It's been a fun, it's been a fun second phase in life, or the next, I don't know, second phase of which phase I'm up to, but the next phase has been very interesting, and getting a chance to teach at Columbia and to work at the Intrepid Museum and here in Manhattan, and to write a couple books and to do a lot of speaking and TV. And that's been kind of fun. So, you know, we'll see what comes next, but I'm enjoying what I'm doing now as well.
And it at least to us in our little space capsule here in the podcast, we kind of get the impression that the outlook on all things space nowadays are on the move up, and people are more positive and seeing more opportunities, and there's more, I would say, traction to the whole space industry. Do you share that view?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm going to right after this call, I'm going to have to sign off soon, I think, because I'm supposed to get to, with some of my students. They're going to be flying something. We're going to be talking about an experiment that they've designed. The students designed it totally. I'm their advisor, but they did it, and they're going to be launched on a SpaceX rocket to the international. Not the students themselves, but the experiment is going to be up on the International Space Station. Think of students being able to do that years ago were impossible. They had to win a competition, a NASA competition, to do that. But they're one of five universities in the United States. Columbia is, and this group of students that I'm going to talk to here later this morning, we're going to talk about that. And we wouldn't be able to have that conversation, you know, even just a few years ago. So the access to space now is much higher than it was. And it's a possibility for lots of research, for development, for entertainment, for vacations, for once you get that access, people start thinking about how they could use it. You know, it started, I think, with the space station we were worried about building it and getting it going. But then after that, you know, in the last 10 years or so, we've been able to concentrate on the science. And it was this laboratory that's available to qualified scientists or commercial companies that, if there's something you can do, you can utilize the zero gravity space environment to do something useful, something you want to do. It's there for you. We didn't have those options before.
That's
but
true.
Now we do. And I think as a result, people are thinking of more and more ways that they can utilize that capability. So I think that this is going to be an amazing decade moving forward for exploration.
So do we.
yeah. Mike, you say we have to sign off. You have other engagements, but I need to know. You've mentioned it. We were able to solve it, you say. But what was the solution to the stripped bolt?
Oh, yeah. The solution to the stripped bolt, you know, I felt pretty bad about this. We did not have a way to fix it. I was just trying to remain engaged. There was one thing I learned as an astronaut, which was, give yourself 30 seconds of regret when you make a mistake and move on. And this was a tough one to move on from, but I knew that, you know, I could feel bad about it for a little bit, for a couple seconds, but I needed to stay engaged. But I really didn't think there was any way we were going to be able to cut around this problem. But what happened was, one of our engineers in Houston had an idea that maybe I could just tear it off. There were four bolts that were holding that handrail on, two at the top, two at the bottom. And three of the four came out. It was just one on the lower left on the bottom that was still there. And so he thought maybe I could rip that off. But that's kind of something we normally wouldn't do in space, because you could, pulling something like that and ripping it off, you're going to create debris. We didn't know if I could, they didn't know if I could actually do it, if I had the strength to do it. And if I could, what kind of debris is that going to generate? You know, is it going to puncture my spacesuit? Is it going to get into the telescope? So it wasn't something that I thought of or anyone in our front room did. But this engineer in the back room thought about it. In Houston, he called up to the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. They took an instrument out of a clean room, set it up like what we had in space, and yanked on it. It was going to take 60 pounds of force to pull it off, which is something I could do. And then they talked about it and had me tape. Their suggestion was the procedure was to tape the bottom of it, of the handrail, to contain any debris. and give it a couple yanks to yield it, and then one big one at the end to break it off, and that worked fine. And I think the message there really is that, you know, I was in space. I couldn't, you know, I was very far away from the people that came up with that solution. They were far away from me. They were communicating to the control room communicating to the Goddard Space Flight Center. So it was like this everyone communicating over technology to figure out this problem that didn't have much time to figure it out. And I think about that today as we're working over distance, and as a lot of companies are working over a distance. I tell them about that experience and others where, you know, we were able to get the job done even though we weren't in the same room. And so I think that's something that that we need to keep in mind in today's environment.
Also, it's a very good argument for humans in space. A robot could never have done that thing, right?
That's right. You know, that was identified. It was funny as I was reading it. It was actually at NASA headquarters for a meeting, and I was waiting in the administrator's waiting room, and looked at the USA Today. It was right at the end of the space shuttle program, and it said the highlight of showing humans in space was when I yanked that handrail off. Out of all the things, I was like, okay, I was fortunate that they didn't mention I'm the one that created the problem. Yeah. but they gave me credit for the solution. So
yeah. Brute force.
Okay, Mike, thank you so much for taking time to speak to us. And I'm just overwhelmed here. How about you, Nils Johan?
Yeah, this has been fantastic. Really, really great. Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah.
My pleasure, and hello to everyone in Norway. Beautiful country that I've been to a few times, and I hope to get back there when we're able to travel again sometime.
Oh yes.
We hope to see you right here.
We hope to see you around. Yes, we.
Thank you.
And when you come back, you'll be invited to our real studio.
That'd be great.
Not our virtual one. Yes. Thank you.
I would like that. All right, guys.
Der har Mike lagt på. Det altså, jeg så glad for å høre at liksom, løsningen på et kjempeproblem I verdensrommet ble makt og gaffateip.
Og der har vi alle vært. Jeg bare synes det så utrolig deilig å høre den historien, for har vi ikke alle vært der liksom en sånn, ok, vi bare river den løs. Og folkens, romteleskopet der oppe fremdeles og tar bilder, fordi ja. Mike dro det håndtaket løs. Jeg bare synes det sånn, hvis ikke det en god historie å ta med seg ut I vinterkvelden, så vet jeg hva søren.
Nei, strålende.
Så helt på slutten, det jo det vanlige her at vi selvfølgelig på Facebook, vi selvfølgelig på Twitter og Instagram, og du kan støtte oss ved å sende litt penger til Vips eller kjøpe en t-skjorte. Og så må vi altså ha en liten shoutout igjen til Kevin Hall fra London Speaker Bureau. Han den som skaffet oss Mike, og han kan faktisk også, hvis du interessert I å høre Mike, enten I en virtuell forelesning, som vi der vi nå, eller etter hvert I en ekte forelesning, her I Norge, så det faktisk mulig å bestille han. Vi legger ut lenke til det I shownotesene våre, som på romkapsel.no.
Fint hvis dere sier fra til oss, hvis dere bukker han til sånn at han faktisk kommer. Hvis vi bare kan få lov til å sitte litt sånn I bakgrunnen der og være med.
Og som sagt, det virkelig vår plan en dag, så skal vi ha han her, fordi, bare så det sagt, vi fikk ikke snakket om den andre ferden, vi fikk ikke snakket om da han var med på å utvikle systemet for å styre Canadarm og alt Altså, vi så vidt I gang, og som dere hørte, Mike kan fortelle.
Ja, det et eller annet med amerikanere, så de svarer.
De naturlige, lange setninger. Ja.
Ja, gjør det. Men, ja. Og jeg vet, hva skal vi gjøre nå, liksom?
Hva skal vi gjøre nå? Ja, nei, vi, vet du hva? Vi har faktisk planer. Det kommer mer, folkens.
Denne podcasten produsert av Tid og Lyst.
Forsiktig nå.
Ja da, det alltid litt å gå på med den sensoren, skjønner du? Hæ? Sånn?
Ja, det var det god.
Hva var det?
Med bilforsikring Super I Storebrand du forberedt på overraskelser. Storebrand. Oi, sann. Du beholder blant annet bonusen ved parkeringsskade. Storebrand. Invester I fremtiden.